Okay, I think we'll go ahead and get started if that's okay. I'm nobody. Who are you? Are you nobody too? Then there's a pair of us. Don't tell. They'd banish us, you know. Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome here. This is the workshop on poetry as communication and connection, so if that's what you're after, you are in the right place. I confess I'm feeling very strong connections right now with Emily Dickinson. The biographies say that she was a recluse who never left the house, but I'm pretty sure she wrote those famous lines when she was asked to lead a workshop on writing. How dreary to be somebody. How public. Like a frog to tell your name the livelong day to an admiring bog. I do have a name. I'm Marlene Brubaker, and I come from northwestern Ontario in Canada, where we had minus 52 here back in February. I'll explain that at the start because my accent might throw you off, and I'm a little bit like Stephanie. I talk too fast when I get nervous. On to business. Our subject is poetry, and not just any kind of rhymes, but the ones that actively change hearts. I assume that if you showed up in this workshop when you had four other interesting options, it's because you already have a love of poetry and more than a basic understanding of it. So we are not going to waste class time on any basics like rhythm and rhyme. One more thing, a subject like this is tricky because there's, 40, 50 people here in this room? That means we've got 40 or 50 separate opinions on what quality poetry actually is. When my dear mother, who does love me, heard that I was asked to speak on poetry as communication and connection, she said, "It's not even the kind you write." Some of you might be thinking the same thing. It turned out that she thought of old ballads as the type of poem that really communicates, and I confess I don't. Poetry is endlessly interpretable. It is more than the sum of all its parts. It cannot be explained in mere words, and any really good poem is going to mean different things to different people. Poetry is like house cleaning methods. Some kinds I like, some kinds you like, a few things we both like. There never was one stanza written that everyone is going to feel the same about. So poetry is not going to have the clearly defined rules of European football. When I got the request to teach this class back 6 months ago, I was venting about it to my three teenage sisters at home. I said, "I don't know enough to teach people to write poems. So much of learning happens on your own through practice. All I can say is go home and read lots and write a little bit and read some more and keep at it." One of my sisters replied so calmly, "Oh, you can talk about alliteration and assonance and metaphor." And another of them broke in and said, "We learned all that in grade 6. Now, that's a funny story, but I want you to think about it. Somehow, this exchange does embody part of the tension we're feeling. We all know about alliteration and assonance and metaphor, if you please. We recognize quality poetry. The verses that shape us, that linger in our memory for years after reading. But even so, we collectively turn out these ditties and doggerel for our church papers that put us to sleep if we try reading them. Somewhere there must be a key. What are we missing? What is the secret to excellent poetry? The kind that really touches and awakens hearts." And I actually want your input. Like, this is not a rhetorical question. So start thinking about it, and we're going to come back to that in a few minutes. In the meantime, I was going to ask who all writes poetry, but I won't, because why are you here? So how many of you write only poetry and never touch any other kinds of writing? Okay, that's kind of what I expected to see. Not a single hand went up. There are probably people like that in the world, but most of us do enjoy other kinds of writing too. The Canadian author Charles G.D. Roberts, who is much more famous for his essays about bears than for his rhymes, said that even though he lived for poetry, he had to live by prose. Most of the tips we'll discuss today do not apply only to poetry, but to all quality writing. Now, back to that question I asked you. What do you see as the keys to writing poetry that truly communicates and connects? I think I'm going to write them down on the whiteboard, so that means I'm expecting you to actually come up with some.
question was, what are the keys to writing good poetry? Feeling deep emotion.
Okay. Emotions.
Having original thought.
Originality.
Honesty and vulnerability.
Thank you.
Purpose.
Oh. Honesty. Vulnerability. Oh, how do you spell that? You get rattled up here. Hopefully you all know how to spell it in case I forgot. Okay, what was that else? Purpose. You did good.
Experience.
What else? Those are really good.
Passion?
Brevity?
May I add that brevity can be overdone, as I have seen in my brief experience as an editor. Some people, they don't write enough to really engage the emotions of the reader and their attention. They glance at it and they see right away, oh, I know what it is. And they just say everything in black and white. There's nothing left of the reader's imagination, and it just kills it.
Okay. That's good. Brevity can be overdone. Now, I know exactly the type of poem you're thinking of there, although I'm not sure if that was actually the point of, if it was actually the fault of the brevity, or if we could call it predictability. Predictability is a bad thing. I'll underwrite it up here.
I'm not sure what you would call it, but yeah. I understand. Yeah. Brevity is good.
Yeah. Okay, these were all good.
George Whipple said, "Remember, it's not what you feel that's important. It's what you make others feel." That is what we are here to discuss this afternoon. You don't care how beautiful I think a loon's haunting yodel is at sunset. If my description of the laughter and the waves lapping around the boat and the moon rising over my shoulder doesn't make you gasp, then I failed. Philosophers claim that the taste of the apple actually lies in the contact of the fruit in the mouth and not in the fruit itself. I'm going to leave that debate to the scientists. But in a similar way, the power of the poem lies in the meeting of the words and the reader, and not in those little black symbols printed on the page. So for the writer to make a connection, there has to be a reader. That sounds obvious, but allow me to quote from Stephanie Linebuck. Remember, our subject today is connection. She says, "You owe your existence to them, those strangers on the other side of the page. I speak of readers, of course. Without readers, you can't be a writer. Okay, you could fill a dump truck load of journals during your lifetime and command them to be burned upon your death, fulfilling your need for creative expression without another eye seeing a word of it. You could, but why would you? If you have a desire to write and enough concentration and persistence to get words on the page, then you should do something with them. The child of God looks for ways to serve others. Don't bury your talent in a drawer. Go out and invest it. Spend it. Use it up. In the upside-down mathematics of God's kingdom, the more you give your talent away, the more you will increase the value of what you have to offer. We can't force anyone to read our writing. We have to make them want to. This is the agony and beauty of writing, to spin ideas in our heads and pull them out, word by word, onto pages where they have the power, if we do it right, to make readers laugh and cry and hold their breath." End of quote. And here I'm going to stop and read a few poems that do this for me. These are poems that stir my soul, reach that place deep inside. I don't think anybody turned up here in this class that doesn't like poems. "The House of Christmas" by G.K. Chesterton. "There fared a mother, driven forth out of an inn to roam, in the place where she was homeless. All men are at home. The crazy stable close at hand, with shaking timber and shifting sand, groweth stronger thing to abide and stand than the square stones of Rome. For men are homesick in their hearts and strangers under the sun, and they lay their heads on foreign soil whenever the day is done. Here we have battle and blazing eyes and chance and honor and high surprise, but our homes are under miraculous skies where the Yule tale was begun. A child in a foul stable where the beasts feed and foam, only where he was homeless are you and I at home. We have hands that fashion and heads that know, but our hearts we lost so long ago. In a place no chart nor ship can show, under the sky's dome, this world is as wild as an old wives' tale, and strange the plain things are. The earth is enough, and the air is enough, for our wonder and our war. But our rest is as far as the firedrake swings, and our peace is put in impossible things, where clashed and thundered unthinkable wings, round an incredible star. To an open house in the evening, home shall all men come, to an older place than Eden and a taller town than Rome, to the end of the way of the wandering star, to the things that cannot be and that are, to the place where God was homeless and all men are at home. Interlude by Claudia Lehmann. You dressed in common clothes and walked beneath the galaxies you made. You bore the whispered insults, and you wore a borrowed father's name. There was dirt beneath your nails, there were blisters on your palms, and when storms caught you on the road, you did not speak a maker's calm. For 30 years, you wept at tombs and did not stop the mourner's cries. Day after common day, you watch the rolling rhythm of the skies within a sunburned little town. Your shoulders bowed beneath the curse, just smoothing wood and driving nails and holding up the universe. Creator by Elizabeth Rooney. Jesus, Jesus, carpenter of Nazareth. Can you make a lintel? Can you make a door? Jesus, Jesus, carpenter of Nazareth, can you make a universe where there was none before? Jesus, Jesus, carpenter of Nazareth, living in the midst of us, a working man and poor, how shall we esteem you, holy, humble carpenter? By the universe you made, and also by the door. Here's one more I should read just for the fun of it. We're talking about connections, remember? Takes Talent by Don Marquis. There are two kinds of human beings in the world, so my observation has told me, namely and to wit, as follows. Firstly, those who, even though they were to reveal the secret of the universe to you, would fail to impress you with any sense of the importance of the news. And secondly, those who could communicate to you that they had just purchased 10 cents worth of paper napkins and make you thrill and vibrate with the intelligence. You see, writing poetry is a little bit like moving abroad and learning a second language. If any of you have spent any time overseas, you know the headaches that accompany constantly trying to choose the right word and remember the right tone with which to deliver it. Translation is dangerous business. One word wrong and the marketplace is laughing. In many ways, all writing is translation. We're attempting to take these huge themes of life and the universe and the contents of our brains and squeeze them down into tangible words. By the way, I thought this analogy was original with me, and then I saw that Dr. Samuel Johnson had called poets the interpreters of nature. Bother. There really is no new thing under the sun. Many a good poet has railed over his inability to put down precisely what he felt. But others get so consumed with the mechanics of the translation that they miss the heart entirely. That is what we want to avoid. Excellent writing goes beyond the form and text into those murky regions of echo and shadow and tone and innuendo, nuance, ambivalence, all these mysteries that we can try to discuss, and I guess that's why we're at Writers' Conference, but can't actually be fully explained. Much comes simply of reading the masters and practice. And so I'm going to repeat what I said in the beginning. I can't teach you how to write poetry. You have to do that yourself. But now I'm going to promptly contradict myself, and we are going to spend the rest of our time talking about rules of writing. Opinions about rules evolve over time. I became more aware of this in my research when I came across someone condemning what he called cheap alliteration. That made me jump. My first reaction was, who changed the rules on me? And the second was, hang on, who made them in the first place? Oscar Wilde and his contemporaries claimed that art and morality were separate realms. They insisted on the doctrine of art for art's sake. We as Christian writers here today are not going to quickly fall for that rap about art and morality. Where we stray sooner is confusing the connection between heart and craft. Too much heart and not enough craft produces sappy emotional writing that leaks exclamation points at every joint. We call those writers 13-year-old girls. Just kidding. But you know the kind. We've all been there. These dear aspiring writers are so sure that the strength of their own emotions is enough to invigorate all the writing. I felt it so strongly, it came from my heart. Yeah, I was there. Unfortunately, genuine feeling guarantees nothing if it's not accompanied by skill. T.S. Eliot said that significant emotion is that which has life in the poem and not in the history of the poet. That is profound enough, I should almost repeat it. Significant emotion is that which has life in the poem, or in any other writing, and not in the history of the poet. Real poetry does not speak to the ages. Real poetry speaks to people. So much for too much heart and not enough craft. But too much craft and not enough heart produces writing that sounds like an owner's manual. Technically flawless, but so dry, who cares? We call those writers, relax, I'm not going to use any names here, but most of you here are ladies. You can picture sewing machines with that little tension dial that has to be adjusted very precisely for the stitching to work, remember? Here's point number one. For communication that connects souls, keep your tension dial balanced between heart and craft. Now, the subpoint to that is that we do need heart. We need vulnerability. I said that already. There will be no connection if there's nothing to say. Now I would like to read a familiar poem by Amy Carmichael, Fire Words. O God, my words are cold. The frosted frond of fern or feathery palm wrought on the whitened pane, they are as near to fire as my words. Oh, that they were as flames. Thus did I cry, and thus God answered me. Thou shalt have words, but at this cost, that thou must first be burnt by red embers from a secret fire, scorched by fierce heats and withering winds that sweep through all thy being, carrying thee afar from old delights. Doth not the ardent fire consume the mountain's heart before the flow of fervent lava? Wouldst thou easefully, as from cool, pleasant fountains, flow in fire? Say, can thy heart endure, or can thy hands be strong in the day that I deal with thee? For first the iron must enter into thine own soul and wound and brand it, scarring awful lines indelibly upon it. And a hand resistless in a terrible tenderness must thoroughly purge it, fashioning its pain to power that leaps in fire. Not otherwise. And by no lighter touch are fire words wrought. This is the price. Marilyn Priebus wrote, "If I cry when I write, I touch something in others." Robert Frost said, "No tears in the writer, no tears in the reader." But deliberately trying to make the reader tingle isn't going to deliver. That's not what we're after. We're interested in the balance of emotion and art. I have a few more poems here that I consider examples of work that could have very easily become sappy and mawkish, but the authors were too wise. Indranila, also by Amy Carmichael. Dear little feet, so eager to be walking, but never walked in any grieving way. Dear little mouth, so eager to be talking, but never hurt with words it learned to say. Dear little hands, outstretched in eager welcome. Dear little head that close against me lay. Father, to thee I give my Indranila. Thou wilt take care of her until that day. For Randall by Sheila Petrie. This was when her youngest brother drowned in July of 2015. Yes, here we weep, and it is hard. There is no other word. But there he sings. I'm sure he laughs. He worships by the lamb, runs leaping through a far green field. Or does he fly? And in a moment, in the twinkling of an eye, this hard path here will end. Some unexpected bend, some high, high cliff. This hard thing here will yield, and you will fly, and he will say, I only got here yesterday. You're here already. Hey! And you will run together through a far green field. A sonnet by Malcolm Gweet, who was one of my favorite contemporary poets. These bleak and freezing seasons may mean grace when they are memory. In time to come, when we speak truth, then they will have their place telling the story of our journey home. Through dark December and stark January with all its disappointments, through the murk and dreariness of frozen February, when even breathing seemed unwelcome work, because through all of these we held together, because we shunned the impulse to let go, because we hunkered down through our dark weather and trusted to the soil beneath the snow. Slowly, slowly, turning a cold key, spring will unlock our hearts and set us free. Just as I did not say to spill our entire soul on the carpet in our longing for connection, I also did not say to tiptoe round in a fever of terror lest we would be perceived as sentimental rather than cool. One of the signal marks of Gerard Manley Hopkins' works is how he is always so emotionally present. That's why reading The Windhover is such a lush experience. Vulnerability is good. We established that already. Rather, I quote Paul Valéry, quote, "A poet's function, do not be startled at this remark, is not to experience the poetic state. That is a private affair. His function is to create it in others. The poet is recognized by the simple fact that he causes his reader to become inspired." Unquote. That is the connection we are seeking. So, what is the most common advice that all authors are given by books and editors and writers' conferences? I suppose there could be a variety of answers here. That's right. Show, don't tell. Probably what we hear about the most often. Now, I see a bunch of you here that were also in Stephanie's class that we just came out of. She gave us an excellent crash course on this already. I wasn't studying my program well enough. I hadn't realized what was going to be preceding this class, so we're probably going to be covering some of the same ground. I guess if I get too stuck, Stephanie, I can call you up here to help me out again. A question, is that always true? Should we always show and not tell? Okay, this is a rhetorical question for those of you who come out of Stephanie's class, but what do you say? She was talking about stories, we're talking about poems. Should we always show and not tell? I see some heads shaking. Point number two is know when to show and when to tell. Now that's hard. I can't even tell you how to do that. Much is lauded about poetic imagery, and I'm not here to downplay that. But have you ever noticed that some of the greatest classics employed both? Here is a quote from the book Robert's Rules of Writing by Robert Mazzello. He says, quote, "Writers have been hearing about the value of showing for so long they've begun to forget the value of telling. If you've got something worth showing, then by all means show it. If it's dramatic action, let us see it happen. If it's a scintillating exchange of dialogue, let us hear it, every word. But don't be afraid to tell us things. Don't be afraid to enter into your tale, to limit its greater dimensions and suggest its meanings." That was good enough for Dickens, who told us right off the bat in A Tale of Two Cities that it was the best of times, it was the worst of times. Use a fine brush when you have to, but take some broad strokes too. Life is short. So is the attention span of most readers. End of quote. Here are some excerpted lines from the climax of Tennyson's Ulysses, when the old man is ready to board his ship. Listen how Tennyson so masterfully weaves both showing and telling in this. "There lies the port. The vessel puffs her sail. There gloom the dark, broad seas. Old age hath yet his honor and his toil. Death closes all, but something ere the end, some work of noble note may yet be done, not unbecoming men who strove with gods. The lights begin to twinkle from the rocks. The long day wanes. The slow moon climbs. The deep moans round with many voices. Come, my friends, 'tis not too late to seek a newer world. Push off, and sitting well in order, smite the sounding furrows, for my purpose holds to sail beyond the sunset and the baths of all the western stars until I die. It may be that the gulfs will wash us down. It may be we shall touch the happy isles. Though much is taken, much abides. And though we are not now that strength which in old days moved earth and heaven, that which we are, we are." Those last couple lines are so strong, and they are sheer telling. Another poem, The Oven Bird, by Robert Frost. He plainly tells us what to think in this one. "There is a singer everyone has heard, loud, a midsummer and a midwood bird, who makes the solid tree trunks sound again. He says that leaves are old, and that for flowers, midsummer is to spring as 1 to 10. He says the early petal fall is past, when pear and cherry bloom went down in showers on sunny days a moment overcast. And comes that other fall we named the fall. He says the highway dust is over all. The bird would cease and be as other birds, but that he knows in singing not to sing. The question that he frames in all but words is, what to make of a diminished thing?" Song of the Wise Men by Lynn Martin. "Deep in the halls of the King of the Stars, eons and eons away, silversmiths hammer their luminous bars, molding and pounding the ray that will journey through beauty and darkness and space to the earth, a celestial lode, straight as a meteor, sure as an ace. It betokens a westerly road. Oh, let us follow, be watered and fed, sleeping on pillowy sod. Why should we wander when we can be led? Drawn by the beacon of God." Is there any discussion at this point? How do we know when to show and when to tell? Can somebody help me out here? Because I honestly do not feel like I have the answers at this. Well, I don't have the answers on anything, but for sure not on this point. About when to show and when to tell. Are there any thoughts on that? I know that's a vague question. Yes?
I've heard it said once, telling is often the best thing to happen when showing will not bring any deeper emotional connection.
Okay.
I heard it in a way better way that sounded way more profound.
But that was the idea anyways. If showing isn't going to produce any significant emotion, then you may as well tell it. Mm-hmm. Good point. Anything else?
Mm-hmm. I think there's also a time when we have become so loaded down with pictures of speech and sensory perceptions that our minds need a break, and to simply be told will be more refreshing than another barrage of word pictures.
True. Very true. Now, that, of course, is presupposing that the telling isn't just going to be a whole string of cliches, but we're not going there. Going on to point three, use concise words. I'm going to call them pivotal words, because words are our only tool when it comes to good writing. What else do we have? Coleridge rather huffily said, "I wish our clever young poets would remember my homely definition of prose and poetry, that prose equals words in the best order, and poetry equals the best words in the best order. And don't keep bothering me, all you young whippersnappers who think you are poets." Bill Moore said, "Poets use words. They must be the absolutely and completely right words for that particular moment and setting." He also said, "Painters work with color and form. Musicians work with sounds, rhythms, intervals. Poets work with words. And words are peculiar things. They slither away from you." Two poems by Daniel Hess that I want to insert in here. "Envy most I those who easily express their thoughts with words. They just dispose of complex metaphors like stubborn knots and clink down words like dominoes. Some of us remain confined to poetry, i.e. not wishing to complain. It's all we see on which to tie our damp interior thoughts so they can dry." And he has another one. "All men are poets. Anyone who uses words, that is. Some more, some less, with differing taste. With any art, the best does not negate the rest. The place to start with words is here. There are no synonyms. Repeat. So don't rely alone on sight, but also ear. And not just ear, but depth of thought. Each word in proper time and place will help portray the fine detail and scope of thoughts unheard. Words fail to capture beautifully when, say, a lot of words are flung with careless glee, as in a shopping addict's spending spree. See, words don't purchase thoughts, but sell. It matters that you use them well. With parsimonious care, release each word, on paper or in speech, and craft the pre-selected thought you wish to reach. Conceive the thought, and recognize that not just any word or words will summarize exactly what you mean. Don't know yourself, I understand. But thoughts can ripen on the shelf. And while that's taking place, give heed to repetition, rhythm, rhyme, and speed. There are no synonyms. Remember, when beauty is at stake. And men are poets, all, with different taste. But some have only sampled frozen paste." Some of you will remember the poem in the CLP literature book that begins, "Poets make pets of pretty, docile words. I love smooth words like gold enameled fish that circles slowly with a silken swish." A French poet, whose name I'm not even going to try pronouncing, said, "You don't make a poem with ideas, but with words." Now, mind you, a few ideas behind them don't hurt your pretty words. I have a few examples I want to read on this point, too. I might quote snatches rather than entire poems this time. "The Second Coming" by William Butler Yeats. "Turning and turning in the widening gyre, the falcon cannot hear the falconer. Things fall apart, the center cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world, the blood-dimmed tide is loosed, and everywhere the ceremony of innocence is drowned. The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity. Surely some revelation is at hand. Surely the second coming is at hand." I'm going to stop there. This one always impresses me.
First, because Yeats died 100 years ago, and if he thought things were bad in his day. But the line that really amazes me is the fourth one. Let me read it again. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. If I'd been writing that, I would have said sheer anarchy, blatant anarchy. I don't know what I would have said, but Yeats said mere. And with that one word, he plunged that line and the whole poem to depths of irony and horror that I would not have achieved if I would have said sheer. Another example comes from our church hymnal. Very familiar song, I'm sure you all know it. Praise to God, immortal praise. The last two lines that are included in most songbooks are, and for these our souls shall raise grateful vows and solemn praise. I confess I would not have thought of that. I would have stayed with the conventional order and said solemn vows and grateful praise. But this arrangement gives an entirely different meaning. Go home and think about what grateful vows and solemn praise actually are. Those Winter Sundays by Robert Hayden. This one is on your handout. Sundays too. My father got up early and put his clothes on in the blue-black cold. Then, with cracked hands that ached from labor in the weekday weather, made banked fires blaze. No one ever thanked him. I'd wake and hear the cold splintering, breaking. When the rooms were warm, he'd call, and slowly I would rise and dress, fearing the chronic angers of that house, speaking indifferently to him who had driven out the cold and polished my good shoes as well. What did I know? What did I know of love's austere and lonely offices? That last line, austere, is the only word that would have worked there. Dickinson, 'twas such a little boat that toddled down the bay. What toddled? But it works. Tennyson, he clasped the crag with crooked hands. It's fascinating that in some of the earliest editions of that poem, the opening line apparently reads hooked hands instead of crooked hands. Not hard to tell which is stronger. That's the same masterpiece that mentions the wrinkled sea beneath him crawls. Never thought of that either. D.H. Lawrence talked about a bat that was caught in his room as flicker splashing. Can't you just see that? John Donne once commanded to unravel this curdled cloud, wash out the stain of the sun, bind up the Thames. Bind up the Thames? I wouldn't have thought of that. I would have felt pretty clever if I had said hold it back or dam it up. That doesn't pack half the punch of bind up the Thames. D.H. Lawrence also said, now in November, nearer comes the sun down the abandoned heaven. Abandoned, that's November. Archibald Lampman had this brilliant verse. From somewhere on the slope nearby, into the pale depth of noon, a wandering thrush slides leisurely his thin revolving tune. Now, a thin revolving tune is unusual enough, but what really catches our eye is that the thrush is sliding the tune. What does that make you think of? What do you slide a tune? Harmonica? I don't know, what do you all had in mind? A.E. Stallings has a poem called Failure that I don't particularly like. But there is a masterful word in the first line that is just amazing. You humble in. It's just as you remember. The sallow walls, formica countertop, circular argument of time. I'm not going to read the rest of it. We could talk about pivotal word choices all afternoon, but we have to move on to put these words together. Oh, one more point. Some Christmas Stars by Lucy Shaw. Blazes the star behind the hill? Snow stars glint from the windowsill. A spider spins her silver still within your darkened stable shed. In asterisk, her webs are spread to ornament your manger bed. Where does the spider find the skill to sew a star? Invisible, obedient, she works your will with the swift silences of thread. I weave star poems in my head. The spider, wordless, spins instead. Writing is hard work, Sila. But really good writing looks spontaneous, like spiderwebs. The best technique is the one you don't notice. Or, as Richard Sheridan dryly noted, you write with ease to show your breeding, but easy writing's vile hard reading. Quoting Dr. Johnson again, what is written without effort is read without pleasure. The masters, of course, revise constantly. If you remember Elizabeth Bishop's poem that begins, "The art of losing isn't hard to master," you might like to know that the Vassar College Library has 17 different drafts of that one piece. I'm not that dedicated. I've never even tried revising any of my pieces 17 times. Yeats sums it up the best when he says, "A line will take us hours, maybe. Yet if it does not seem a moment's thought, all our stitching and unstitching has been naught." Trifles, said Michelangelo, make perfection. And perfection is no trifle. So let's move on to just a few of these techniques that will take us hours, maybe. I promised we wouldn't talk about alliteration and assonance, so we won't. But there are a few other lesser-known techniques that could handle another look. Let's quickly discuss synecdoche and metonymy first. Can anyone give me definitions for those big words? Synecdoche is a literary device in which a part of something represents the whole. From The Rime of the Ancient Mariner by Coleridge, the western wave was all aflame. The day was well nigh done. Almost upon the western wave rested the broad, bright sun. See, the western wave is a synecdoche. It refers to the sea by the name of one of its parts, which is a wave. This is also used in the Lord's Prayer, by the way. When Jesus taught us to ask for our daily bread, he wasn't referring to a diet of straight carbs. He was using bread as a synecdoche for all food. Now, metonymy is almost the same thing, but it's the substitution of the name of an attribute for the name of a thing meant. Synecdoche was a part for the whole. Metonymy is an attribute for the whole. For example, in metonymy, we talk about the collar instead of the clergyman. Or Parliament Hill, let me see, down here you would say the Oval Office instead of the current government. That's metonymy. Here's a verse that's full of metonymy. Scepter and crown must tumble down, and in the dust be equal laid with the poor crooked scythe and spade. That's metonymy. One more, enjambment. This one is probably better known. Enjambment literally means to stride over. I thought that was interesting. It's when a line continues grammatically into the next line and there's no pause brought on by a period or a comma. There's no natural termination at the end of the line. Most times this is used very sparingly, but I want to read a poem by Gwendolyn Banks that really showcases this technique. It's called The Pool Players. It's about 7 at the Golden Shovel. We real cool, we left school, we lurk late, we strike straight, we sing sin, we thin gin, we jazz June, we die soon. See what that did? It gave the whole piece this bizarre syncopation. It kept you a little bit off balance the whole way through. It sounds swaggering and rebellious and real cool. And when you reach that last line, it sounds like a coffin lid slamming shut. See, if she had handled those lines in the ordinary way, it would have just said, we real cool, we left school, we lurk late, we strike straight, and so on, which is an entirely different poem. Extraordinarily different. Now, I'm not recommending you all go start writing poems about gin, obviously, or that you fall for enjambment quite that wholesale. Few of us could master anything quite like that. But I'm going to quote Jamie Langston Turner when she said, with no enjambment, the lines stand dully with a complete thought in each. This is pedestrian and flat-footed instead of dancing. Moving on to one more technique, the withheld image. We're going to spend a little more time on this one. The withheld image is, to a certain extent, understatement. It's holding back a crucial piece of information, not to conceal, but to reveal added nuances. Many things may be suggested rather than stated directly, and sometimes, depending on the subject, artistic effect is actually compromised by plain statements. Now, I hope I'm not undercutting what you're going to tell us next, Stephanie, but I think it's true. I'm going to quote at length from John Frederick Nims. Please forgive me. It was easier just to quote him than to paraphrase him. Quote, "Poets, though they may think in images, often work selectively. They give us only so much of what could be a confusing overabundance. Often give us synecdoche, for instance, instead of totality. They know silence often speaks louder than words, and an image can be the most vividly present to us when it is not mentioned at all." It was Voltaire who said that the way to bore people is to tell them everything. What not to say and what not to do is the secret of many arts. Dizzy Gillespie, the jazz trumpeter, said, "It took me all my life to learn the biggest lesson of all, what not to play." Robert Frost would agree that the same is true for poetry. He said, "The unsaid part is the best part." See, we like to complete meanings for ourselves. A poem that starts us out on a process of discovery involves us more pleasurably than one where the poet tells all. Now, just an aside here, never layer quotes the way I'm doing right now. I'm switching from Nims to off on an aside. This is why many of us prefer short, punchy poems. Another quote inserted here in the middle, this one is from Sheila. "A wordy piece of rhymed prose insults the reader. It says, 'You cannot understand what I am saying, so I will explain it to you. You probably won't get it on the first explanation, so I will say it five more ways.' A short, insightful verse says, 'Read me. What do I mean? Mine my depths and make discoveries.' A bad poem says, 'Think this.' A good poem says, 'Think.'" Now, switching back to Nims again. "Never tell a reader what will leap to his own mind without you telling him. Mature writers prefer to understate so that the meaning can explode within the reader and not just in the words on the page." End of quote. That was kind of a heavy quote. I hope you got it. It is on your handout in case you need to digest it again some other time. It might seem that I'm contradicting what I said earlier about vulnerability and heart. I am not advocating frigid rhymes with nothing to arouse us. But if poets are strong enough to imply their feelings rather than letting them gush, we will be more moved in the end. Edwin Arlington Robinson's poem, The Mill, is a very classic example of withheld image. It's a morbid one. I apologize for that. It's also the best example I found. I don't think I have time to read it. You can go home and look it up. It's a classic. He just gives us clues in this one and sets us at playing detective ourselves. And when we finally catch on at the end that he's describing a double suicide, it fills us with as much horror as if we would have stumbled across the bodies ourselves. Here's another that I really do want to read. Listen carefully and somebody tell me afterwards who is talking about what. I think you'll be able to get it. It's an excerpt from Seawalk by Gilbert Morris. "Look, Tullius, through the dungeon bars. You see? Why, do not turn pale. I've seen a cross or two before. My son, one particular cross I mind. But no matter now. Tomorrow, all will be well. All will be well for me at last." "Why, Tullius, you weep. A Roman soldier weeping for a Jew. Peace now, and think how gracious God has been. Remember when you came to be my guard? Ho, Tullius, how tough you tried to be. watching with your soldier's eyes, a sneer on your young lips. Oh, you struck a pose. And I caught you in my net, as once I caught the fish in Galilee. My bait, I told you the master, until soft grew that warlike eye, and you were captured by his power, as I myself was caught by him long before your birth. You have been my lamp in this dark place, for as I spun for you my tales of Galilee of long ago, how we walked with Jesus through the earth, so real it seemed again. I am grown old and tired too, but now all will be well for me tomorrow. What's that? Can I walk unaided there, you ask? So far as to my cross? Oh, son, more eager than you ever ran to sweetheart, I go for this last walk, for there all will be well for me at last. It grows late. Get you to sleep. My little walk tomorrow, what then? A few faltering steps, a pain or two, and then, my faithful Tullius, why then all will be well for me at last. Who's talking about what?
Peter talking about his crucifixion.
That's right. It's Simon Peter, the night before his crucifixion. And you see how that, it became more vivid because it never said. Here's another one by Janice Eder. Passage. Out of a struggle in darkness, into the air and the light. Out of the sameness of blindness, into bewildering sight. Out of a lonely seclusion, into the sound of our voices. Fearful, protesting, reluctant, though everyone waiting rejoices. Come, little baby, and welcome. Don't be afraid of our touch. Here, let us wrap you and hold you. Long have we loved you, and much. Loosed from the bonds that restrain you, you lie on a comforting breast. The long, weary waiting is over. Sleep, little baby, and rest. Now, that one is exquisite just at face value, but I hope you caught she's actually talking about the death of a Christian. At the beginning of class, we said the number one point is to keep a healthy tension between heart and craft. And then we spent most of our time discussing craft. I'd like to circle back now and talk about heart in closing. As Christian writers, we are interested in not only connecting with our readers, but communicating truth by this connection. A person's view of God shapes his art, and our writing can be both a gift from God and a gift to God. Here's a poem that is not on your handout because I found it only about 10 hours before I left home. Discovery by Kagawa, who was a Japanese Christian. I cannot invent new things, like the airships which sail on silver wings, but today a wonderful thought in the dawn was given. And the stripes on my robe, shining from where, were suddenly fair, bright with a light falling from heaven, gold and silver and bronze light from the windows of heaven. And the thought was this, that a secret plan has been hid in my hand, that my hand is big, big because of this plan, that God, who dwells in my hand, knows the secret plan of the things he will do for the world using my hand. We do not normally think of Walt Whitman as a mentor on Christian communicating. That's an understatement, I guess. But I want to read his poem on the spider. A noiseless, patient spider. I marked where on a little promontory it stood isolated. Marked how to explore the vacant vast surrounding, it launched forth filament, 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 out of itself, ever unreeling them, ever tirelessly speeding them. And you, oh my soul, where you stand, surrounded, detached in measureless oceans of space, ceaselessly musing, venturing, throwing, seeking the spheres to connect them, till the bridge that you need be formed, till the ductile anchor hold, till the gossamer thread that you fling catch somewhere, oh my soul. Yeah, we circled back to spiders. They make such inspiring muses. I hope nobody here has a severe phobia of them. Now, a commentary on this poem by Jennifer Trafton. The mastering of an art requires vast amounts of alone time. Poems emerge from silence. Their birthplace is a quiet gasp of wordless wonder. There comes a time in our adolescence that we learn that the world is broken. Not only that, but we are broken. Like Humpty Dumpty, we cannot put ourselves together again. But after redemption, grace thrives in broken soil. It launched forth, filament, 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 out of itself. Here is the paradox. You cannot make art except by being alone, and yet you cannot be an artist in isolation. Along with the wonder born in solitude comes an irrepressible urge to turn to someone else and tell him or her about it. That creative impulse in you speaks two things. First, make this. Then, share this. Do not hold it tightly to your chest. Cast it out of you and let it fall. Then cast it out again and again till the bridge that you need be formed, till the ductile anchor hold. I have come to believe that in order for art to be art, it must be given. Creativity is at its heart an act of self-giving, and it is given in gratitude for having received something. It is an act requiring great courage. Courage to stand in the lonely place and at the same time be conscious that one is surrounded by faces and be constantly reaching out of the loneliness into communion with the world. Art is always reaching. Here is a further paradox. In order to not be alone, you must go by way of aloneness. In order to find one who may receive your words, you must have the courage to first send those words on the journey out of yourself into a world that might not receive them. You must fling that gossamer thread out across the oceans of space, and flinging is not a safe, calculated movement. It is reckless abandon. It is a motion of both carelessness and joy. And so, this is all that I want to say to you in the end. Fling your silken soul far out into the world, little spider. It will catch. It will catch. One more poem in closing. You reading this, be ready. By William Stafford. Starting here, what do you want to remember? How sunlight creeps across a shining floor? What scent of old wood hovers? What softened sound from outside fills the air? Will you ever bring a better gift for the world than the breathing respect that you carry wherever you go right now? Are you waiting for time to show you some better thoughts? When you turn around, starting here, lift this new glimpse that you found, carry into evening all that you want from this day, this interval you spend reading or hearing this. Keep it for life. What can anyone give you greater than now, starting here, right in this room, when you turn around? Thank you. You're dismissed.